pushing ahead with its plan to construct more than 1,200 new settler units in occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds. U.S. police arrest at least 20 protesters as violence erupts during rival rallies over the outcome of the recent presidential election. Iran's parliament speaker says only practical measures of the next U.S. administration matter to Tehran in its dealings with Washington. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Israel is moving forward with a plan to construct more than 1,200 new settler units in the occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds. The Israeli Housing Ministry opened up tenders for new construction on Sunday. The plan would further cut off access for the Palestinians in the city of Bethlehem and East Jerusalem. The project is a red line for the Palestinians, who call it a lethal blow to the prospects of a unified Palestinian state with Jerusalem Al-Quds as the capital. Now, the announcement of new settler units comes ahead of the U.S. Secretary of State's visit to Israel. Mike Pompeo is set to visit a settlement in the occupied West Bank, the first such move by any top American diplomat. The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump has given an unconditional support to Israeli settlements, which are illegal under international law. Now, let's learn some more information. Mona Candila, our correspondent, joins me now from Ramallah to give us some more detail on this. Mona, and this is, looks like to be maybe further anger by the Palestinians, I believe, because it's cutting off Palestinians' access to parts of the city.
Well, that's right. Now, they are speaking about 1,200 new settler units in the illegal Israeli settlement of Givat Hamadas. It's in the center of Jerusalem, Al-Quds. And as you were saying, it will cut off Bethlehem from Jerusalem, Al-Quds, as well as the Palestinian town of Beit Safafa in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, from the surrounding villages. However, now Israeli media are saying that there are not only 1,200 units, however, more 180 units. Those are new, and the tenders were made in addition to 1,357. So the total number would be over 1,200 settler units, and the plans were suspended for years because, according to the international law, all settlements are illegal. However, building in areas in the center of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, would be should not be allowed. Now, as you were saying, it's only several days before the visit of U.S. Secretary of State to Israel, Mike Pompeo, and the deadline for submitting the tender is January 18. It's 2 days before the inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden, and it seems that the Israeli regime is racing time in order to approve more settler units before the change of the U.S. administration. They fear that the new president might force the Israelis not to build more settler units in the occupied territories. This is why they are racing time. They are approving more settler units, and they are welcoming the visit of Mike Pompeo. It's the first visit by U.S. Secretary of State to illegal settlements, because these settlements, in any agreement in the future, the lands should be part of the Palestinian state, in addition to East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, with the Gaza Strip. However, the Israelis continue to build in these settlements, annex and seize more Palestinian private lands in order to make it possible for expanding the illegal settlements, at the same time preventing Palestinians to build on their own lands in areas adjacent to the illegal settlements.
Thanks for that, Mona Kendall in Ramallah. The Israeli military has hit several locations in the besieged Gaza Strip with airstrikes and artillery fire. Israel says the attacks targeted underground infrastructure and security posts of the Hamas resistance movement. Gaza sources saying that the attacks hit areas in Khan Yunus, Rafah, and Beit Hanun, among other locations. Tel Aviv claims the strikes were in response to overnight rocket fire from the Gaza Strip. Israel frequently carries out attacks on that enclave. Gaza has been under siege since 2007. Tel Aviv has also waged three wars on the coastal strip ever since. Clashes have erupted between supporters of President Donald Trump and counter-rallies in Washington, D.C. This amid growing tensions over the recently held presidential election. The arrest came just hours after thousands of demonstrators marched through downtown D.C., echoing support for Trump's claims of election fraud. Far-right groups, including Proud Boys, clashed with ralliers, including Black Lives Matter activists. U.S. media is saying that 20 people have been arrested, including some on firearms charges. Tensions have continued since U.S. media projected Democratic candidate Joe Biden as the winner of the 2020 presidential race last Saturday. Trump has rejected the results, launching legal challenges on the basis of claims of fraud.
Divisions in the still undecided and highly disputed U.S. presidential election have spilled into the streets, with supporters of President Donald Trump marching across the nation for the first time since the vote. Counter-protests for Democrat Joe Biden, who has a small lead in an election which appears far from being certified, were also held nationwide. The chair of the Federal Elections Commission said this week in an interview he believes reports of voter fraud in key battleground states are credible. Post-election polls show that a whopping 70% of Republicans now believe the vote was not free and fair, a doubling from pre-election numbers. 10 days after the vote, Trump has still not made a public address, but it appears that just one of hundreds of lawsuits could push the election into the hands of the Supreme Court, like in the year 2000.
They are attempting a coup. There's a possibility that Trump, you know, refuses to accept the election, even though it's obvious that there was no widespread fraud. In fact, there wasn't even any little fraud. I mean, maybe a few votes here and there. They're demanding these recounts.
The third disputed election in six tries has many conservatives, independents, and leftists saying that this presidential vote needs the balance of judicial branch oversight in order to reestablish confidence in America's electoral process. What's certain is that Biden cannot legally be declared a victor by the media or public opinion. The rallies come as emotionally and economically devastating stay-at-home orders expand across many states due to the long-expected autumn wave of coronavirus. This week, Trump said there would be no national lockdown and reportedly backed off trying to get Congress to finally release a desperately needed second household stimulus. The U.S. is clearly on edge, but Biden supporters remain confident that the unprecedented use of mail-in ballots did not lead to voter fraud and remain confident in the electoral process.
I think that the biggest thing we can do right now is insist on the truth and fight for the truth, you know? We won. That's at the end of the day, Biden is president-elect. He's going to be 46, you know? That is the truth.
Trump supporters contend that they aren't getting a balanced amount of airtime in the mainstream media and over such a critical Democratic issue, but they also express faith in America's electoral and judicial processes. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Now, in other news, the Iranian parliament speaker says only practical measures of the next U.S. administration matter to Tehran in its dealings with Washington. Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf says that Iran will be pleased only if U.S. sanctions, including those targeting oil and banking sectors, are scrapped. He says Tehran must pursue the lifting of the sanctions, but warned against any signal by the government that would put the country in a weak position. U.S. projected President Joe Biden has promised what it calls a credible path back to diplomacy with Iran once he enters the White House in January. Has also vowed to return to the 2015 nuclear deal between Iran and world powers. Incumbent President Trump pulled out of the deal in 2018, reimposing tough sanctions on Iran. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council says that defense and security ties between Iran and Iraq are guarantors of regional peace and stability. Ali Shamkhani made a comment while meeting with Iraqi Defense Minister Juma Anat Sadoun in Tehran. Shamkhani stressed that Tehran and Baghdad should boost their defense ties to the strategic level. He called the withdrawal of U.S. forces key to regional security and stability. Sadoun thanked Iran for its help during Iraq's difficult times. He also called for increased collaboration between the two countries. The Iraqi minister earlier met with Chief of Staff of Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Hossein Baghari. During the meeting, Baghari said boosting Tehran-Baghdad defense ties will help improve the Iraqi security. 15 Asia-Pacific nations have formed the world's largest trade bloc by signing the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or RCEP, and that happened during an online ASEAN summit in Hanoi. The RCEP is composed of 10 ASEAN members, as well as China, Japan, South Korea, Australia, and New Zealand. Vietnam, which hosted the ceremony, says that the RCEP will account for 30% of the global economy and reach over 2 billion consumers. The China-backed pact has excluded the U.S., which left the rival Asia-Pacific grouping called Trans-Pacific Partnership in 2017. The RCEP will take effect once it's ratified domestically by signatory states within the next 2 years. It'll help lower tariffs across many areas. India pulled out of related talks in last November, but ASEAN leaders say that the door remains open for New Delhi to join back. Now, Pakistan has come up with a domestic dossier by detailing what it calls hard and specific evidence of Indian involvement in terrorism across that region. The evidence has come on the heels of a major escalation at its borders with India and disputed Kashmir region. Javed Rana reports from Islamabad.
Fresh border clashes have erupted in disputed Kashmir region, divided between both nuclear-armed Pakistan and India. This is the aftermath scene of a major border escalation. Over a dozen houses were burned to ashes when Indian military carried out mortar and rocket attacks on civilian population. One Pakistani soldier and 5 civilians died, while 33 others were injured. In retaliation, 5 Indian troops were reportedly killed. Many have migrated from the troubled bordering region to safer areas after heavy skirmishes.
It's a serious escalation. We have given them a very befitting reply. There have been massive losses on Indian side in men and material.
Many Kashmiris took to the streets to protest against India over the civilian casualties.
They don't fire on the Pakistani posters. They just kill the civilians, knowing the fact that the people of Azad Jammu and Kashmir are in support of the freedom movement of Jammu and Kashmir, and they want to demoralize the civilian population so that they should back out from their support which they are giving to the people of Jammu and Kashmir.
The border tension has been high between two neighbors since August last year, when India forcibly annexed its part of disputed Kashmir region into its federation. The merger of only Indian majority state was done in defiance of 11 UN Security Council resolutions which call for a referendum to let people decide on whether they want to stay with India or join Pakistan. Pakistan has come up with a comprehensive dossier providing specific details of what it calls Indian aggression fast reaching to its mainland from Kashmir region through different terrorist outfits.
India is a state sponsor of terrorism that it is consistently exhibiting rogue behavior. If the world does not take the Indian agenda to destabilize and undermine Pakistan and the region seriously, I'm afraid, then peace and stability in a nuclear South Asia does not seem to be their priority.
India also blames Pakistan for supporting what it calls terrorism in its controlled Kashmir region. The battlegrounds between Pakistan and India seems to have spread far beyond disputed Kashmir region. Citing intelligence reports, Islamabad has blamed New Delhi to have set up 87 terrorist camps, 21 in India and 66 in Afghanistan. Officials here say that India has also recruited over 700 militants, including those of Daesh terrorists, to carry out terrorism in Pakistan and false flag operations across the region. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The death toll from Typhoon Vamco that hit the Philippines earlier this week has risen to 67. Many areas on the country's largest island of Luzon and in the capital Manila remain submerged in the worst typhoon-triggered flooding in decades. Disaster management officials say at least a dozen people remain missing. Vamco made landfall on Wednesday, packing strong winds and rains. It damaged farmlands, roads, and houses, forcing 200,000 people to leave. Police soldiers and Coast Guard have been deployed to assist in rescue efforts. The Philippines has experienced six cyclones in the span of just 4 weeks. At least three people have been killed and more than a dozen others injured as police used pellet guns and tear gas to disperse anti-government protests in the Peruvian capital, Lima. A thousand-strong rally began peacefully with chants demanding the resignation of interim government of President Manuel Merino. Things turned ugly after some of the protesters began throwing rocks and fireworks at police, leading to deadly clashes. Peru has been gripped by some of the largest protests in decades when Congress removed former President Martin Vizcarra on corruption charges last week. A Congress speaker now saying that Vizcarra's interim successor must immediately resign over the deaths during the protests. That's all for this news broadcast we had for you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense. A new model for the presence of the people in the arena of sacred defense and the cultivation of talents.
Once I paid a visit to Ahwaz and I saw a group of ladies, honorable ladies, gathering somewhere and washing the soldiers' dirty clothes. This signifies that everyone was able to find their place and to help. Surgeons could also show their presence, and they did so, as we were witness. Small business people, the clergy in mosques, workers in factories, poets, panegyrists, drivers, entrepreneurs, welders, rural farmers, employees in government bureaus, and all kinds of other people could participate in that large network.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Was a new model. This is unprecedented in the world. We have not read anywhere about such models, nor have we seen it anywhere. There are many books and movies about various wars, and we have read many of them, but such popular cooperation and assistance is completely unprecedented in the world. It was a new model and a new way of creating it. Everyone was able to cooperate, to have a part, and to offer their assistance. And in such collective movements, exceptional talents usually show up. For example, such and such a young man from a village in such and such an area of the country, for example, a village in Kirman, would go to the city and would join the forces, and later he would become a personality like Hajj Qasim Soleimani.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
All of us are in debt. You, me, businesses, governments. The great machine of the economy is now powered by debt. We live on credit. Our homes, our cars, our schools, our government expenditures are financed by borrowing. Debt has become the lifeblood of the economy and the engine of global growth. We're all caught up in an economic machine that creates more and more debt day after day. That machine is running wild, out of control, and public debt, the debt held by governments, is soaring. The Eurozone is having a much harder time than other economies emerging from that debt crisis. Why? And what are the solutions?
It's a debt machine, yeah. Once you're on it, it's very hard to get off it.
Let's start over and create a system of credit and debt which would actually be sustainable, which wouldn't destroy the planet as the current debt machine is doing.
When its debt reaches a certain level, a government gets caught in a spiral. To repay its debt and the interest on it, the government has no choice but to borrow more money year after year. Most of the countries in the Eurozone are now in that situation. They borrow heavily on the financial markets and from large private banks that fight fiercely to keep them as clients.
Banks love to make loans to sovereigns. Why? Because behind the sovereign are millions of taxpayers. And they're not like the shoppers, or it's not like the consumers in a business, because those taxpayers never go away. There's a new one born every single day. And they're going to pay taxes for the next 150 years, unless the country collapses. So why wouldn't you lend to them? Because you know you're going to get your money back. You know there's no bankruptcy law. You know that you can always make a profit on it. It's safe lending. Whereas if I go to a firm that wants to innovate and produce a new asset, you know, a firm that maybe wants to, has decided they want to build steam engines in 1700 or something, I then have to assess the risk. Well, that's too risky. Why should I invest in that? Why don't I lend to the government of Spain or to the government of Italy or to the government of Portugal? I know there are German taxpayers, there are French taxpayers there, all of whom are effectively backing up this debt. So I have no fear of taking risks.
In Europe, government debt is staggering. 500 billion, 1 trillion, 2 trillion euros. But those figures don't really mean much if you don't compare them to the wealth of a country, its gross domestic product, or GDP. A country's debt is measured as a percentage of GDP. Here, debt represents 50%, and here, 100% of GDP. When the Maastricht Treaty was enacted in 1992, European experts decided that in order to keep debt from getting out of control, countries must not allow it to exceed 60% of their GDP. But that critical threshold has been largely exceeded by most European countries.
C'est une situation catastrophique parce qu'à partir de ce moment-là, vous n'avez plus la possibilité de faire ce que vous voulez en matière de politique budgétaire.
When debt rises above a certain level, tax revenues end up going to pay interest on the debt instead of funding government expenses, hospitals, schools, teachers. How can the debt be repaid? How can we get out of that spiral? Debt has always existed. It dates back to the origins of civilization. It even predates the invention of money.
The very earliest Mesopotamian inscriptions that we have are actually debts and credits. Calculating who owes what to whom within temples and other large bureaucratic systems. So what you have actually are credit systems, and in Mesopotamia, they didn't have cash.
While private debt has always existed, public debt, government debt, first emerged in Italy and the major trading cities during the late Middle Ages. Florence, Genoa, and Venice were constantly at war, which cost them dearly. To pay for those wars, sovereigns borrowed from prominent patrician families. The first government bonds were traded, paying interest. Those prominent creditor families would found the first Italian banks, which started lending a lot of money to European monarchs, who were caught up in endless wars. Most often, the bankers were ruined by the warlike rulers, an easy way of getting rid of debt, one that would be used for centuries. At the time, governments had power over creditors. Only much later would that balance of power be reversed. After the Second World War, everything had to be rebuilt. Thanks to the support from the Marshall Plan and to massive money creation, the industrialized countries experienced exceptional growth. The 30 years after the war were good. So good, they are known as the economic miracle in Germany and the glorious 30 in France. Business was brisk, industry was in full swing, and growth in consumption was spectacular. By the end of the post-war boom, in the early 1970s, government debt in Europe was at record lows thanks to growth and inflation. But the economic machine would soon be upset by two major events.
Good evening.
First shock. On August 15, 1971, Richard Nixon, President of the United States, whose coffers had been emptied of their gold reserves by the Vietnam War, announced a staggering measure that would drastically change the world economy.
To defend the dollar against the speculators, I have directed Secretary Connally to suspend temporarily the convertibility of the dollar into gold or other reserve assets, except in amounts and conditions determined to be in the interest of monetary stability and in the best interest of the United States.
But it was not a temporary measure at all. The U.S. president definitely cut the fixed relationship between the dollar and gold. The dollar became a floating currency like every other currency around the world.
All the currencies of the world that were either tied to the U.S. dollar or the British pound by 1971 were now pure fiat currencies. They're not backed by anything. They're just backed by the confidence that people have in those currencies.
That abandonment of the gold standard cleared the way for significant currency market speculation. The free circulation of capital on international markets intensified. It was the beginning of a period of great financial instability. Two years later, in 1973, another major event occurred, the first oil crisis. In 1 year, the price of crude oil soared, going from $2 to $6 a barrel. The sudden increase in the price of oil weighed heavily on the world economy. It put the brakes on growth. Production costs went up. Prices went up. Inflation skyrocketed. High inflation has a major drawback. It impoverishes savers and investors, since their money depreciates. For governments, inflation became the new enemy to be defeated at all cost. Starting in the 1980s, the industrialized countries began to borrow heavily on the international market, after which their public debt would never stop increasing. Margaret Thatcher came to power in England and Ronald Reagan in the United States. It was the advent of neoliberalism, an economic doctrine that also spread throughout Europe. Governments everywhere were lowering taxes, privatizing public assets. These would be the years of easy money. Stock markets expanded, Wall Street in New York, the City in London. On both sides of the Atlantic, governments deregulated bank credit. Unchecked capital flows moved through markets worldwide. By dint of deregulating and liberalizing, those governments became dependent on financial markets, which by then were an inescapable part of the economic system. The debt machine was taking shape. Everyone went into debt. Governments, businesses, and individuals. The economic system had turned into a machine for creating debt. And the banks got rich on the interest paid by borrowers. Credit became the primary fuel for growth. But how does credit work? Banks possess only a small amount of the money they lend. Money is created by private banks on a simple request for credit and a promise of repayment. The sum is erased as soon as the loan is repaid.
That is a huge thing. It's how we've always created money from the beginning. And it's a wonderful thing. If you have a banking system that can create credit like that, that is a very good thing. Because it means you can create finance in a crisis. You can bail out AIG. You could finance climate change. You can finance a war. And that's how we've always done this. The public hasn't understood that. The public thinks that money comes from me working hard, digging the soil, working hard, and at the end of the month, I earn some money. The central banks produce 5% of the credit in the world. The private banks produce or create out of thin air 95% of the credit in the world. And they have virtually no regulation over that. Now, what Keynes argued in the 1930s was, we must manage this process. It can create vast bubbles of debt. It can go out of control. We must manage it.
After the crash of 1929, the great British economist John Maynard Keynes warned politicians. The credit machine needs to be controlled so that it operates not just to benefit speculators, but to benefit all of society.
When we managed the financial system between 1945 and 1971, there was not a single financial crisis anywhere in the world. And then in 1971, the bankers lobbied and they said, no, we don't need controls. You know, the market will discipline us. We will blah, blah, blah. And we began to lift all these regulations. And then crises began one after the other, first at the periphery and then in the core.
1999 saw the advent of the euro and the creation of the European Central Bank, which would ensure its stability. At the time, global growth was strong. The level of public debt was starting to decline. Europe was breathing easy. Confident, financial markets lent generously to governments. And the weakest economies, Spain, Greece, Italy, Portugal, suddenly had access to loans at very low interest rates, close to those available to Germany. That low-cost financial windfall was an economic boost. All was well. Meanwhile, on the other side of the Atlantic, the housing bubble was expanding, and then the subprime crisis struck. Thousands of homeowners lost their homes. They had taken out loans with interest rates that rose sharply, and they found themselves unable to make their mortgage payments. Many banks were in danger. On September 15, 2008, Lehman Brothers, one of the largest U.S. investment banks, collapsed. After the fall of Lehman Brothers, European banks with close links to American banks risked bankruptcy in turn. Governments only just managed to save them in order to avoid the collapse of the whole system. In Spain and in Ireland, after the advent of the euro, and thanks to loans from German, French, and English private banks, developers invested heavily in real estate. If governments had to bail out the banks, it was because they could no longer be allowed to go fail, since those banks are us. They are the accounts of millions of citizens. We are caught in the machine. The economic crisis and the government bailouts of the banks led to a spectacular increase in public debt in Europe. The debt machine raced out of control. first country to declare bankruptcy was Greece in November 2009. The newly elected Prime Minister, George Papandreou, revealed the real figures that had been hidden by the previous government. Greek public debt had reached 129% of GDP, well above the 60% threshold set by the Maastricht Treaty. He asked for help from Europe. Would Europe respect the Maastricht Treaty, which forbids the European Central Bank from bailing out indebted countries? European governments hesitated. Would they guarantee Greece's debt? Should part of it be restructured or canceled? Or should they help Greece pay its creditors? The heads of state could not reach an agreement. While Europe was hesitating, markets were speculating on the Greek debt, and confidence collapsed.
The fear was that if Greece restructured its debt, might the markets pull back from Spain, from Italy, from La Belle France, and might not Europe bring upon itself the catastrophe that it so wished to avoid. And therefore, the argument was, it is far better to give Greece all the money it needs to repay its indebtedness than to run the risk that the market would perceive a sovereign restructuring in Europe as infectious, as contagious.
Only after six long months of crisis did Europe finally decide, despite resistance from Germany, to lend Greece enough to pay its creditors.
Not one euro of debt has been written down in these years. What has changed is the identity of the creditor. So money was owed to bondholders in 2010. It's now owed to the IMF and the EU. If you can solve a debt crisis simply by changing the identity of the creditor, then this one is solved.
Being in debt isn't only about owing money. It's also about being in the wrong. There's the financial debt, but also a moral debt that weighs just as heavily on the inhabitants of the indebted countries. Debt and guilt. Double jeopardy.
Just because I happen to live in Greece, somehow I'm a sinner, I'm a bad person because of some political acts done by political representatives of one kind or another. Therefore, it's okay for people to have their lives destroyed. It's okay for people to have to pick through garbage and not have anything to eat. It's okay for cancer patients to be denied medicine. If we're ever going to have morality in the world, we need to absolutely reject that logic. If there's individuals responsible, hold them responsible. But don't hold a collectivity responsible for the deeds of the few.
To resolve the Greek debt crisis, Europe granted it financial assistance. In exchange, it imposed a draconian austerity program. The country was placed under stewardship and lost part of its sovereignty. It is under surveillance by the Troika, three delegates of the European Commission, the European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. Other countries in the Eurozone, also over-indebted, would be controlled by the Troika in turn and subjected to similar austerity programs. Portugal, Ireland, Greece, Spain, the pigs. The inhabitants of those countries feel like that's how the rest of Europe sees them. In Spain, half of the young people are unemployed, and government debt is about to reach 100% of GDP. The sound of those protests reached all the way to Brussels. The Troika had become a curse. So much so that the European Parliament held a special session about the Troika's actions. National and European MPs questioned European leaders.
I am absolutely confident and sure that if Greece did not implement the program, the situation will be much worse today. I am convinced of that.
Europe is a disappointment. the austerity programs were poorly implemented and poorly explained. Europe is starting to look like an evil monster, kicking people while they're down. All over the continent, there is increasing support for nationalist parties. Anti-finance and Eurosceptic parties are gaining ground.
We're going to see reaction to the liberalization of finance, just as we saw it in the 1920s, and it's going to be ugly. It already is ugly. It's ugly in Greece, it's ugly in France, it's ugly, you know, in many parts of the world, where people are saying, if my government won't look after my interests, if my government will not arrange for my young people to have employment, then I will look for a strong man who will do that for me, who will give me security and give my children employment security. And I don't care what sort of strong man it is. If he's a fascist, I don't care. If he promises to secure the stability of my life and my people, I will vote for him. I think that's where we are heading. And I don't think our leaders have the vision to understand that's the threat that we face.
So what are the solutions? How can we curb that debt machine? What mechanisms can we use? Why not play on inflation like other countries do? After the Second World War, French and German debt was two or three times higher than it is today. But inflation literally absorbed it.
Tilt the banknote to see the hologram and emerald number. Worth a closer look. The euro, our money.
A strong euro benefits the countries of Northern Europe, but penalizes those of the South. Is Europe going to fall apart? Could growth return and reverse the trend? And why not? United for better or for worse. Debts of European nations, unite!
To have a monetary union work effectively, what happens is that the more efficient regions, or in the case of the Eurozone, countries, become even more efficient and wealthier. The poorer regions, or less efficient regions, become poorer and less efficient. Italy's south was industrializing until the country unified and in the 1860s and 70s. And once that happened, if you were an Italian investor in the south, why would you invest money in the South when you could earn more money by putting your savings in Milan or investing it in the north of Italy? So the South became steadily poorer. So what did the Italians have to do? They had to always, and they're still doing it, had to send money to the South regularly, not lend money, but give grants. And in the old days, they had the big Cassa per il Mezzogiorno, the fund for Southern Italy, which paid out tens of billions of dollars over a century. I mean, endless payments that have been needed. The wealthier provinces have to send money to the poorer provinces, not lend money, send it.
An appealing idea. Unfortunately, the Maastricht Treaty stipulates that each country must manage its debt alone. Europe is far from being a cohesive union. And yet, in 2012, for the first time, the president of the European Central Bank, the ECB, took political responsibility within the Eurozone.
The euro is irreversible. We will do whatever it takes within our mandate, to have a single monetary policy in the euro area and to maintain price stability in the euro area and to preserve the euro.
But couldn't we simply just erase the debt?
I personally feel that a general jubilee would be really helpful. This is something that's happened throughout human history. It's not unprecedented. And even recently, some quite conservative regimes have done it secretly. I believe that not only Saudi Arabia, but Kuwait, I think maybe Bahrain, as their way of fending off social unrest, the first thing they did during the Arab Spring was cancel debts. Debt cancellation can be done to preserve the social order, but it can also be done to transform it. Most revolutions involve cancellation of debts. Ironically, German prosperity now is based on the cancellation of German debts after World War II. It seems very ironic that the German public is absolutely unwilling to even renegotiate debts of countries like Greece, calling them debt centers, when in fact all debts were canceled after World War II, and it was that freedom which actually made the German economic boom possible.
Europe has long been powerless against tax evasion. It is finally taking action now, requiring transparency. The champions of bank secrecy, Switzerland, Austria, and Luxembourg, have agreed. Debt, the economy, and finance are on our minds constantly these days. We're all caught in the debt machine. The debt, its grip, and its dictates have insinuated themselves into our relationships with others and into our lives. But debt is not life, and we must learn to free ourselves from it.
IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You are listening to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The program is Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss the problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers that you will be hearing are mostly based on the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. And we have in our studio our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad, to help us with our questions. He is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, dear Brother Miqdad. It's always nice to have you here in the studio.
Alaikum salam, rahmatullah to you and to all the listeners. Thank you so much.
Okay, so we're continuing our last episode, and the question was, my three-year-old is very cranky and moody, cries a lot. I've tried everything, like giving sweets and telling her off, but it just doesn't work. So in the last episode, we said that children have physical needs. We have to check that they're getting enough sleep, that their nutrition is right, and maybe we need to even show them to a physician. It could be a vitamin deficiency. And then we went on to mental needs, and one of that is that a child might be acting cranky because they need attention. You said that we have to show our children that we love them. We have to express our love to our children. We also explained that it shouldn't go so far as to becoming exaggerated and making the children too attached. It should just make them feel secure in the family, that they are loved, that they are welcomed, and they will be taken care of. So when we're talking about showing love to our children, do we mean that we have to express I love you every now and then, like every 48 hours after lunch? Or should we demonstrate it, or should it be a mixture of these two?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Definitely not the version that you mentioned. That it should be faked. It's not a fake thing that you want to make a routine out of it, that every 48 hours after lunch you have a ceremonial discussion about the way you love your children. No, definitely not. We're talking about something very natural. It's a good question, because you have to understand how it comes, right? It comes with a lot of giving importance to the family. I think one of the key things that happens, or one of the things that happens in today's world, is that we somehow give priority outside the house, right? And nowadays, unfortunately, both the mom and the dad, our work is outside the house, our social, our even learning, everything happens outside the house. And suddenly, what's inside the house is very neglected, basically, and it's not given too much importance to. Unfortunately, it's quite common within our community as well. Even community where I'm talking about people who are normal married, right? Normally married, normal children, nothing. We're not talking about people who are outside the religion. So there is a family there, right? But the attention that we give to the family is not so strong. So the moment we change this focus a little bit and say, yes, I've got my work and my social and my football and my food and restaurant and my community, etc., but I also have my house, and my home is very important to me. Once we do that, then the focus changes, the attention changes, and suddenly love naturally comes, right? It's not something you impose upon yourself. It's not something you have to keep reminders. You know, I don't want people from now on to put a reminder on their phone, for example, that by today I should put a task on my phone that I should say I love you to my wife, for example, or to my children. No, that's not the case. It's a matter of changing our focus and saying, look, my family is very important, and I need to show love, and naturally love will come.
All right, thanks. We'll take a break now, and after the break, we'll be back for further discussions on this issue. And remember, these can be questions for the children of not your family, but your community, so they are just as important. Stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing with Brother Mehdad. We're talking about three-year-olds who are cranky and cry a lot. And we're talking about one very important element in raising children, and that is showing them attention and love so that they feel secure. And you pointed out to a very interesting point just before the break, the fact that we should pay attention to the family. It should play a bigger role in our family. I think I agree with you, in the sense that I see a lot of fathers who interpret their love and devotion to the family in their ability to bring more money into the house. And so they dedicate their lives into producing as much money as they can. And of course, there's no limit to how much money you can produce. So their lives is taken over by jobs and anything that can produce money. Do you agree with that? And any messages for them?
I think it's a very cliche probably movie scene, basically, when the father says to the wife, or the husband says to the wife, look, I've been working 12 hours, 13 hours a day just to bring enough food, just to bring food from your table. And the wife says, I don't want your money, I want you, right? It's a cliche scene where just saying that